I'd like now to welcome Larry Rasmussen. He is Professor Emeritus of Social Ethics at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. His new book is Earth Honoring Faith, Religious Ethics in a New Key. Now, he will be teaching a class on the book at the United Church of Santa Fe on Mondays in February and March. And he will also be doing a seminar this summer in June at Ghost Ranch, which is open to the public. And we'll talk about that in a little while. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So this is a book, essentially an exploration of eco-theology. What is the historical relationship between ecology and theology, if there is one, in Judeo-Christian religion? Is there that kind of tradition?
There is. Most all of it, however, is pre-industrial revolution, at a time when people live in more immediate contact with the seasons, with the elements, earth, air, fire, and water, when our built habitat wasn't our primary habitat, then the Abrahamic traditions, and really all religious traditions, had an experience of nature as human beings that is qualitatively different from what has happened since the rise of the Industrial Revolution.
Well, they had a different experience, but was that in any way part of their religious practice?
It was. If you look at, for example, in the Earth Honoring Faith seminar at Ghost Ranch, one year we did water and a baptismal life. Look at any religious traditions, whether major world religions or indigenous religions, there aren't any of them that don't have water rites, R-I-T-E-S. There are no religious traditions that don't make food and sharing a meal together a sacrament of some kind or another. Yeah, they certainly do reflect in their own theology and in their religious practices.
So baptism would be an example?
Baptism is an example, yeah. And the question that we always raise now, because the modern relationship of religion and ecology, which begins, the second half of the 20th century, is one where we became increasingly conscious that we were not taking into account in human responsibility the well-being of the primal elements themselves, soil, air, fire, water. So when we did water and a baptismal life in the Earth Honoring Faith series, we asked, what is the relationship of the literal waters of life to what we claim are the sacramental waters of life? We use the same phrase, waters of life, both places. And that has its parallel in other religions too. But we ask now, we need to look anew at our responsibility here, because not only is there an intimate relationship, the difference between pre-industrial revolution and post-industrial revolution society is that human beings never had the impact on the rest of nature before the Industrial Revolution that we now have. I mean, right now, scientists are talking about the fact that we're entering a new geological age. They've given it a name, the Anthropocene. And that name is a reference to the fact that all nature now, whether you're talking about the atmosphere or the oceans, the great commons of the planet, is impacted by the domination of human activities. That was not the case when these religious traditions themselves were formed and their interaction with the rest of nature at the time that water or food or the Spirit of God is referred to as the breath of life. I mean, all the primal elements are there, but in a context where human beings did not have this kind of impact, and where, on balance, human activity has become largely destructive of the primal elements, which are the parental elements for the whole community of life.
We certainly, until now, have not had the impact on the earth, the entire planet, the oceans, the land, the sky, and all the air, and so on. But in places, we have. Yeah. In other words, there are certainly indigenous cultures who wiped themselves out through poor use of the earth. And it seems like even indigenous religions have understood their own impact and encoded earth-honoring practices into their own religions, or whatever you want to call them, practices.
Yes, they have. But you're right in pointing to the fact that there has always been, wherever human beings have settled in society, which is from the Neolithic revolutions on down, so 8,000 to 10,000 before the years before the Common Era, there has always been an impact of human beings on the rest of nature around them. And oftentimes that's been very destructive. The Fertile Crescent became an infertile crescent. I mean, you got mounds of unforgiving desert where cities once stood in the ancient Middle East, where civilization itself came into being as we know it, whether it's writing or accounting or a lot of art and architecture. So so it isn't all a product of the industrial era. That is to say, ecological degradation is not. What the difference, however, and it's a very important difference, is that in the modern era, we have a reach with our human impact that those societies did not have. Their impact was local, and it was regional. It was not global. They didn't impact the health of the oceans. They didn't change the jet streams in the atmosphere. Places where human beings have never dwelt, Antarctica,
right.
The polar caps, I mean the high polar caps, now show the impact of human beings. So our daily habits have global reach. Theirs didn't. And so how do we then craft a sense of human responsibility that actually accounts for the consequences of human power? That's something new.
Yeah, and it's a very interesting question. It's really the question of our time. In your book, you show all of these what we call hockey stick-shaped graphs where things are pretty steady, and then suddenly there's a very precipitous rise. And the first and perhaps most important one is population, but there are so many others as well.
Yes, and those graphs, which are in two pages in the book themselves, hockey sticks everywhere, you know, that's everything from McDonald's restaurants to population to investment to impact on ocean biochemistry. I mean, it's the same upward curve everywhere. Toxins in the environment, it's exactly the same. They all start where we have historical data. Sometimes we don't have it, but they all start about 1750 on this, and then the change is very gradual until about 1950, and then it's just utterly dramatic. That's the hockey stick sign. You saw it in Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth.
Right.
You can see it everywhere. And the turning point there is post-World War II choice of developing a global consumer economy when you ended the war and had to convert from a war-based economy to something that provided jobs and provided well-being and that met the demands of a growing population and a workforce, etc. And it was a deliberate choice on the part of for the Roosevelt administration and the Truman administration in Washington to go for, and the Bretton Woods institutions, to go for a global consumer society. And that's the linchpin. That's why it's 1950, where these graphs all shoot up.
So it wasn't just population went up and everything else went up with it. There were some real conscious choices that were made.
There were, absolutely. Now, one of the amusing scenes at the end of the Roosevelt administration is when Franklin Delano Roosevelt meets the head of the House of Saud, Saudi Arabia, on a warship in the Red Sea, complete with a small herd of sheep. And the warship becomes an oasis for the gathering of this meeting. And a deal was cut between President Roosevelt and the head of the House of Saud that the United States would have unlimited access to Saudi oil in exchange for support of the House of Saud, and that big oil corporations would be the facility for doing this. So, yes, and you could go to several other things. There were a couple of major books. There were institutions built, the Bretton Woods institutions, World Bank. These are all post-World War II, or the end of the war, and then into the 50s. It was a very conscious choice.
And that choice accompanied by rising population worldwide.
Population jumped from 1.6 billion in the year 1900 to the flip of that, 6.1 billion. One century. It took all of human history to get to 1.6 billion. In one century, you went to 6.1. 2010, we went to 7. And now we're probably on the way to 9 to 10 billion by 2050. Just 50 years. You know. So it's dramatic.
We're talking to Larry Rasmussen about his book, Earth Honoring Faith, Religious Ethics in a New Key. So what does all of that have to do with religion?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me say first that part one of the book is the effort to reframe the way we think about human responsibility now in light of the new geological age. All of human civilization has been hosted by what was the Holocene in terms of geological ages. The Anthropocene is an age, and human beings have never been around for more than the Holocene. So we've got a dramatically new reality in our hands, and our old ways of thinking about moral responsibility. When I say old, I mean from the industrial era, from 1750 on. That frame of mind does not account for the consequences that we actually exercise in our use of cumulative human power. I say cumulative human power, referring to the fact that it might be rich and poor together that have this kind of impact, and it's 7 billion people that have this kind of impact. So. What are the changes in the moral categories that we think with when we think about what we do? What have been the ways in which our way of life has construed its sense of what we are to be and what we are to do? And so the first part of the book has to revise that, and it has to say that the unit of human survival is no longer human society. The unit of human survival is planetary creation. But the Industrial Revolution didn't give moral citizenship, if you will, to soil, to water, to air, to fire, that is, to energy. Those were all used as resources, that's what we call them. It's an utterly utilitarian ethic. It's actually the master-slave ethic continued, and nature is the slave and we're the masters. That doesn't suffice. That just doesn't suffice. So we have to reframe our understanding of ourselves. Are we a viable species living this way? We have to reframe our understanding of what our moral responsibility is and how we exercise it. That's all of part one. And part two goes to what? And to your question about what religious traditions contribute to what I say is a long, hard transition from an industrial technological way of life to an ecological technological civilization. It's really not an environmental crisis, it's a civilizational crisis that we're talking about. Okay, so what do religious traditions have to do? And the subtitle of the book is Religious Ethics in a New Key. The new key is that justice isn't just human justice. Justice has to be construed, has to be regarded as creation justice. It has to take into account what the requirements for life itself, earth, air, fire, and water, are for their own renewal and their own regeneration on their own timelines. They're non-negotiable. I mean, topsoil operates in a certain kind of way.
Yeah, you can't negotiate with climate. I mean, that's one of the things that's so crazy about the era in which we're living. It's like they go, there are these climate summits and compromises are made, and it's you're thinking, you can't make those compromises because science isn't going to change for politics.
How it runs, right. No, so you've got to take into account these non-negotiable elements in planetary creation. Now, what religious traditions bring to this is part two of the book. And I call them the deep traditions of religious faiths because they're shared over millennia and they're shared cross-culturally. For example, mysticism. There have always been mystics and a lot of kind of everyday mystics. Most people have some kind of mystical experience in which they feel themselves at one with the whole creation, a kind of union or communion with all that is. And mystical traditions are normally either traditions of sometimes people see simply light, but other times most mystical traditions are sort of nature abundant, if you will. I mean, nature is present in the mystical traditions, and it's a powerful presence for those who have those. That's a relationship of human beings to nature, which is different from the industrial relationship, which is utterly utilitarian. The mystic knows that nature has a value and a life of its own that we're a part of, intrinsically a part of, and that we don't veto and we don't create, though we can destroy a good bit of it. So I investigate and ask, what would earth-honoring mysticism be? Because not all mysticism is earth-honoring. Or traditions of the simple life, what technically in eco-theology is called asceticism. Traditions of a notion of life that at its best is spiritually rich and materially simple. Those are traditions that are widely held. And it's not just in the Abrahamic traditions, but Hindus and Buddhists and so on. And I know a whole lot more about asceticism than a lot of, certainly modern Western versions of the Abrahamic.
Right.
Tradition. So what do those deep traditions of the simple life, spiritually rich, materially simple, have to offer to us now? How would they be earth-honoring and help us reconceive our responsibility? And I've got a kind of dual typology, if you will. Each of these, there are five major shared streams of religious traditions: asceticism, mysticism, sacramentalism, prophetic liberative traditions, and wisdom traditions. Each of them addresses one of the major forces that are bearing down on the planet. So what do traditions of the simple life and asceticism say to consumerism? What is the notion of a sacramental understanding of the universe? All material reality is sacred and has a value, again, which we're a part of and participate in, but we don't bestow the value. What does that say to the commodification of everything? So that nature is only is basically natural resources, which are basically commodities, which don't tell us anything about the impact on the land and the peoples where these things were made. That's removed from us. The purpose of a commodity is to be convenient and disburden us from having to produce it ourselves and worry about it ourselves.
Right.
But what is
which we like.
Yeah, of course we do. And that's a huge part of the global economy. So what would it mean to consider food in a more, if you will, sacramental way, or water, as Francis talked about it, as sister water and not just bottled water. Prophetic liberative traditions and issues of oppression, because people don't breathe the same air, people don't drink the same water. The gender, race, class differences show up. It's always been more toxic on the wrong side of the tracks. So prophetic liberative traditions and oppression, wisdom traditions and folly. I mean, it's folly to be using the planet as a huge uncontrolled experiment and how much we can get away with. That's madness.
We're talking to Larry Rasmussen about his book, Earth Honoring Faith, Religious Ethics in a New Key. I think one of the things that's really tricky when we talk about ethics and morality in relation to the Earth is that, I mean, when you talk about, and this doesn't even have to be about religion, but any kind of ethics and morality, you talk about hurting somebody or killing them. I mean, those things we call unethical and immoral, and it takes an act of ill will to hurt somebody or to kill them if you're doing it on purpose. And I think most people have, except for maybe some psychopaths, have a natural conscience telling them that that's not a good thing to do. But at this point, we're doing things like driving and taking hot showers and using our computer and stuff like that. And those things are, in fact, a form of killing if you think about it on the level of ecosystems and global warming. And yet each of these acts in itself isn't immoral.
Yeah, it is immoral, but it's not immoral in the way that you describe
this
conscious intention.
Yeah, it doesn't require ill will. On the contrary,
right.
I mean, these things, I mean, using computers, doing this radio show that we're doing, and all these things, they bring people together.
Yeah.
They foster loving kindness and compassion and all the kinds of things that religious and ethical people are trying to foster.
Yeah. Yes, and of course, the mix of vice and virtue has always been a reality. I mean, almost all of the benefits that are accrued from our behavior have some costs. So it's not as though that were something new, that now we don't have virtue and vice mixed, or that we don't have benefits that are not attached to somebody paying a price for those benefits. What you're pointing to, though, is that you do have to make a distinction between that kind of morality, which is willed, is the conscious, a consciously taken action, and that kind of morality which is institutionalized in the habits of our way of life. And people in ethics have known that difference between personally chosen moral action and systemic structural action that has to do with that system of which our actions are a part. So we were talking earlier about the reality of nature being commodified, and where we don't even know what the costs have been to the land and the peoples of the commodities that bring benefit to us. You'd have to go through your global supply lines, and people try to do that. They try to find out where Walmart is getting its goods and who's producing them there, under what conditions. That's all matters of morality. It isn't that only my choice of product is the end of my moral relationship. That's all a matter of morality. It isn't that, yeah.
But from their perspective, whatever the corporation is, they're trying to compete with all the other corporations that are doing the same thing. And so it's kind of a setup to do the cheapest and most efficient thing.
Yeah, it is a setup. And any economy is a setup. Any kind of economy is a setup. One of the things that's most troubling for me personally in working through all of this is the viability of democratic capitalism as a way of governance and a way of running the human economy, now that it's global consumer capitalism. Is that a viable way of exercising human action and responsibility, considering what it does to the planet through the way in which it is structured?
Right.
Take for example, a democracy. If you're talking about an impact, and we are now, because of climate change, an impact on future generations, and maybe even deep time, because of all the effects of climate change, we're only seeing the beginnings of that. The CO2 and nitrous oxide and methane is up there for a long time. It will have impacts for generations out. How is it that future generations of both human beings and other than human beings get a vote? How is it that they exercise their requirements for their own well-being in a system measured to elections 2 years out, 4 years out, maybe 6 years out at most, and where people are running for office a couple of years after they've gotten into office, where the focus is short-term and the consequences are long-term?
Right.
How is it in an economy that measures how well it's doing by the quarterly bottom line, or at best maybe annual bottom line, how is it that future generations, or even an extension of one decade out, gets a vote in the marketplace? How do you do that? I'm not sure that even the best of what the industrial era offered, and I think democratic capitalism is probably the best, certainly not state-sponsored socialism, which was worse on the environment than capitalism. But I just don't see simple market solutions or simple election solutions as viable for the kind of power that we, to account for the consequences of the power that we exercise. Because this morality, I call our kind of global economy the phantom cosmology of our time.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that it's shaping of the way in which we see the world, and it's shaping of the values that we exercise in the world. It's shaping of our morality. It's shaping of our habits of life. It is a way of life. So phantom cosmology is that it's not paraded as a moral issue when you and I go shopping or stop at the gas station. That's a phantom part about it. But it is a way of acting and seeing the world that we assume and act out of.
I think the whole question of industrial capitalism and capitalist democracy, if that's not an oxymoron, all of that presents us with a very tricky problem, which is that, as you've been talking about, the exploitation of resources and seeing land and air and water and everything as commodities rather than as part of our lives that we are profoundly connected with, I mean, that's putting us on a fast track to potentially catastrophic destruction. And at the same time, we love and use its products. We benefit from its comforts. We have longer lives. We live through nasty diseases. And in many ways, it brings us together in ways that we tremendously value. And very few people want to be ascetic. Very few people want to go back to the land and only eat root vegetables all winter and things like that. So yeah. How do you sort that out?
Yeah. And how do you sort that out for 7 billion people? I mean, you have to remember.
Right, you can sort it out for yourself.
Yeah, you have to remember that we're talking about human needs on a scale that we haven't had to address until the last century or so, because we didn't have the population that was clamoring for it. How do you sort it out? Well, I think it's a series of long, hard transitions. I think they're possible transitions. I would take some issue, let me put it this way. I think these deep religious traditions, whether it's prophetic traditions or sacramental ones or ascetic ones or the wisdom traditions, are traditions that speak to something deep in human nature. That's why they're cross-cultural. That's why they cross the centuries and the millennia. So I think they have a real capacity to shape people's lives. And that's the first thing. The second thing is the common theme in shared religious traditions is death and renewal. It's birth and rebirth. It's dramatic changes from one way of life to another way of life. It's working with the kind of grief that comes when you experience loss of what was precious to you. And it's reconstructing your life out of loss. We're experiencing that kind of thing. And under the impact of climate change, we're going to be seeing the requirements of needing to shift in a way of life. Okay, go to the places that have some experience in themes of death and renewal, birth and rebirth, loss and revival. Go to those places. So I want to argue that there's a great deal that the religious traditions have to offer. That doesn't take anything away from the fact that you'll have to meet human needs and that you will need to do it in a way that doesn't destroy more than it helps construct or reconstruct. And at a certain point in the book, at the end of the chapter 2, with all the hockey sticks, the chapter is called The World We Have, there's a set of transitions that we have to make. And one set of transitions is economic transitions, where you have to find the way in which you make planetary well-being primary and human well-being derivative. Now, scientifically, factually, that is the case. But the industrial area flipped it around or said human well-being is what we'll pay attention to. We won't pay attention to planetary well-being. But, planetary well-being as primary and human well-being as derivative, I didn't say secondary, I said derivative, means that the first law of economics is the preservation of Earth's economy or of nature's economy. How do you then create economics? How do you make the human economy congruent with nature's economy in which it is embedded and of which it is a part? How do you make human technologies harmonize with nature's technologies, which is a way of saying how do you have an agriculture that generates topsoil rather than loses topsoil, helps generate topsoil, or that purifies water rather than pollutes water. So there's an economic transition in which economics and ecology emerge to become economics, and you embed all economic activity within the framework of nature's economy. That can be done, and we need all the good technology. I'm not Luddite at this point. We need all the good technology we can get, but you ask about any human technology.
What you're basically saying is an economic system that prioritizes nature, and so what does that look like in real life? Well, you close large parts of the ocean so the fish can regenerate, so there aren't as many fish available for people to eat, which is fine, but then fish become more scarce and more expensive. Okay, everything that you do that helps the Earth regenerate, especially when you go up to 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 million people, affects the food we eat, makes it more scarce and more expensive at the service of the Earth. And that's a tough set of issues that you have to face, because so much of the world is poor in the first place. So much of our country at this point is poor. Yeah. So,
yeah, and there is no simple. There's no way of doing this in any way that's not tough. And again, part of what I think are what religious traditions bring to this is a certain kind of realism, that you're looking in the face of tragedy here. You're looking into the face of suffering here. And simply to deny that as a reality, it puts us in a worse place than if we owned up to it and faced it. And I think we also need to be cognizant of the fact that our first impulse, our first response will be, if you use a parable of Jesus, to prefer the old wineskins to creating new wineskins. But if you put new wine, the Anthropocene, a different reality of ourselves on the planet, into old wineskins that burst the old wineskins. But our first impulse is to try to find the industrial way answer to this industrial produced problem. And the kind of honesty that and stark realism that our moment requires of us is one which also has to find a way to create new wineskins. And that's in part a technological issue. And like I said, I'm not anti-Luddite here. But, for example, in agriculture, there are lots of scientific studies that show that labor-intensive land use by the farmer can be every bit as productive as the big industrialized agriculture in terms of yield per acre. So you can go local and regional in your food production in a way that circulates well in the economy, puts more money back into the local economy, whether it's farmers markets or whatever the form is.
Right.
Just because that's outside the paradigm of industrialized agriculture doesn't mean it's not more viable. It probably is.
Right. It's more viable in terms of being earth-friendly and being sustainable in the long run. And the question is, what small farmer can afford to hire 20 new people?
Yeah. Well, this again is back to what we were talking about earlier. We've created systems and structures that raise the question as you've raised it. And the answer is, there isn't a poor farmer that can do that. So then what do you have to do to create the incentives and create some disincentives that make it possible for a more cooperative way of doing things? Where I grew up in southern Minnesota, and this is not nostalgia at this point, but it was interesting that my whole family were farmers on both sides. What they did is they owned the machinery together. They went from one farm to the next at harvest time, and everybody harvested with the same machinery, rather than each farmer having to purchase $10,000 tractors or more. I mean, that's a small price for some of the harvesting machinery now.
Scandinavians.
And we had the co-ops. It was a farmer's co-ops.
Right.
For bringing all of this to market. Those are those tall silo buildings that you see in small Midwestern towns. So every time these questions come up, but can you, what does it mean that, you have to ask yourself, inside what paradigm, inside what system, inside what structure is that question arising? And is there a way of thinking outside the paradigm to come at it differently?
Well, and I think one of the real questions facing us is, given this way of life that we have right now, call it the Western middle class way of life, is it even possible, and I truly don't know the answer to this question, is it possible to really change our infrastructure and change the way we make things to be sustainable and earth-friendly, but keep this way of life? Or do you have to pretty much go to a much more ascetic and, I don't want to say simpler, because at this point I don't even know what's simple.
No.
But a really different way of life where we don't have nearly the amount of stuff that we have. This is the question. Do we have to give up this stuff?
Some of it we may have to give up, but there's a reason why we say recycle, reuse, renew, and so on. And what the first place to start is to make all that stuff in such a manner that it can be reused to make other stuff, and that you can do it in such a way that it's earth-friendly.
Is that enough?
I don't think
you
it's...
You don't know, I don't know.
Well, that's absolutely true. We don't know. Then the question becomes a kind of moral and ethical question. What do you do in the face of uncertainty about the road that you feel you must embark on, because not to do so portends worse? It was kind of interesting in yesterday's New York Times, the Sunday Review section, that said the best argument for government action on climate change is climate change. That is to say, things happen that require response. What is New Jersey, what are New Jersey and New York going to do about sea level rise? Okay, they're going to probably have to do something because they don't want the damage of superstorms to continue in the scale that even Sandy was a portent of.
But it's almost like we have to wait for we wait for the disasters before we start doing anything, which may be too late.
Yeah, and it may be. That's one of the unknowns. But like I said, it's back to the question of what you do in the face of uncertainty, in the face of not knowing either if you continue what the consequences will be, or not knowing if you venture off in some other direction that looks like the best direction given what you do. No, and I don't think you can remove that element of uncertainty. So to me, this is another point at which religious traditions, not only religious traditions, common wisdom, has something to say about our actions and what we do. But there isn't a useless farmer's market. There's not a useless photovoltaic system. There's not a useless community garden. There's not a useless cooperative. So it looks to me like there's a series of changes that are already taking place that provide a direction that's more promising than continuing what we've done. And at one point in here, I tried to list just what those elements are. A few examples would be greater economic self-sufficiency locally and regionally with a view to the bioregions themselves as basic to human organization. Agriculture appropriate to a region in the hands of local owners and workers using local knowledge and crop varieties with the ability to save their own seeds, treat their own plants and soils with their own products. Preservation of local and regional traditions, language, cultures, and et cetera. Sense
like
of
that.
The sacred. Yeah, things like that.
So your book is called Earth-Honoring Faith, Religious Ethics in a New Key. What do you mean by faith?
Yeah. Faith is a couple of things. One is that it does include a kind of vision. That is to say, there is something to the reality that people of faith have experienced death and renewal, birth and rebirth, loss and recovery. So there's a vision that the forces of death don't have the last word, that that life triumphs in the end. Individual lives may not, but life will persist. So that's
you don't need religion for that.
No, well, you don't need organized religious traditions. Whether you need religion or not, I mean, I'm a little bit amused because a lot of people will say I'm spiritual or not, but not religious. When, by my understanding of religion, they're religious, but their religion isn't tied to any faith community with which they identify. But they still ask the big questions. Who are we? What is life about? Those are religious questions, questions of meaning and direction.
But I mean, the question of faith, like, to me, I've always had trouble with that word because basically, as far as I can make out, means believing in something that you can't see or prove or know.
Yeah.
Which doesn't seem like a very smart thing to do.
But there are things that are beyond our present knowledge and certitude. I don't believe in, I mean, I want to believe in things I see. And that's part of the prophetic tradition, is that this has got to be enacted in practices and ways of life that you can look at and measure and take account of. It is. Faith, let's try this. Faith, I think, is essentially, a theological phrase, consent to being. It's a saying yes to life in the face of all that is anti-life, and having a kind of confidence that life will, in the end, triumph.
What do you mean by the end?
Well, I mean that there is this force on the side of ongoing life, and that I don't see an end to that. You can have dramatic changes. The Earth has gone through innumerable geological ages after the beginning of, one-celled animals, which were the reality for billions of years, actually, before we had multi-celled animals. Then we had five great periods of species extinction. We're into the sixth great period now. This is the only one humans have been around for and been a part of in terms of cause.
Right.
But out of each of those periods, life has reemerged and actually has flourished in ways that it didn't prior to that. We wouldn't have mammals around unless we had the end of the dinosaurs.
Right.
Because all the mammals were very small. They were kind of from mouse size to dog size. That was it in the face of the rest of life. So when I say faith as consent to being, and a kind of confidence in the powers of life to triumph, that's what I mean by faith. Now it gets.
But there's no particular belief in anything, in any god or whatever.
Well, I was just going to say it gets expressed in a lot of different traditions. If you're Osage, you would talk about the energy that's present in all things, whether it's in you or me, or in the air around us, or in the trees. There's a powerful presence there that's exhibited in the flows of energy, and that's a religious understanding of it. Others, in the Abrahamic tradition, you have a theistic understanding. You have a notion that the Creator is not simply identified with the creation. It's not pantheist. It's a creator that is the source of the creation itself, and the name God gets given to that. In Buddhism, you don't have an understanding of God as separate from that. So,
because there is no God.
No, and you don't have to have a God in order to have a religion. When I say faith is consent to being and a kind of confidence, or in your words, belief in the triumph of life, that may get expressed in theistic ways. It may get expressed without a reference to a God separate from the rest of things. I myself don't think of God as an item on an inventory of the universe. No, it's rather a way of talking about a living, powerful presence that I experience in all of life.
Larry Rasmussen is Professor Emeritus of Social Ethics at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. His new book is Earth Honoring Faith, Religious Ethics in a New Key. And he will be teaching a class on the book at the United Church of Santa Fe on Mondays in February and March. And in June, he's doing a seminar at Ghost Ranch, which is open to the public, called A Desert Faith in a Desert Time. And Terry Tempest Williams will also be there. If people want to get in touch with you, Larry, to find out more about your classes and so on, is there a number or a website?
Yes, sure. The Ghost Ranch website will tell people about that seminar and that series. This is a decade-long series. This is the sixth year. GhostRanch.org. Contact me, and my cell phone is 505 231-0993.
Larry, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.